Hi, hello again. This is Frieda Morrison. Welcome to Scots Radio. And on behalf of the team, a hail and hearty good new year to you all. And I hope you managed to get the hugmanay that you wanted. Am I aware that naebody wants the same and naebody can get the same? But fativer, it's here and we're here and we'll just get on with it. We've a special programme for you to launch this new epoch, an extended interview, speaking to a special person, radio broadcaster and writer Fiona Ritchie MBE, about her new book called Wayfaring Strangers. Now, Fiona has been broadcasting her Celtic roots music to North American radio listeners through her Thistle and Shamrock radio programmes for over 30 years. And she's received numerous awards, including being appointed musical ambassador by the Smithsonian Institution Centre for Folklife and Cultural Heritage. And in her foreword to the book, Dolly Parton pays tribute to Fiona and her co-author Doug Orr for their outstanding job in researching the origins of the troubadours and the balladeers that created the music that became the basis for American folk, bluegrass and country music. They describe that epic musical journey through the Appalachian Mountains in some detail. So, join me now as we hear more about the music and the folk that made up the soundtrack for that epic journey. I join Fiona in her recording studio in Dunkeld in Perthshire, for she's based in this country, making her programmes for Thistle and Shamrock. There's nae pint of me saying ony mair about the book. I'll let Fiona tell you what the book's about.
Well, the book is Wayfaring Strangers. It traces the musical migration from Scotland to Ulster and to the Southern Appalachian Mountains. This is a migration that took place, I suppose, over four centuries, really. In the 17th century, 25 to 30,000 Scots migrated to settle in the plantations of Ulster. In the 18th century, about a quarter of a million of these Ulster Scots, as they now were, travelled over to North America and migrated through Philadelphia, through the Pennsylvania backcountry and down the Great Philadelphia Wagon Road to settle in the Southern Appalachian Mountains. So you had this mass migration of people who had started in Scotland, settled in Ireland. Their music, their songs, their ways, their traditions, their folkways had travelled with them, picking up new influences as they spent some time in Ireland. And then off they went to settle in a completely different place, bringing their music, their songs, their fiddle tunes, their dances and their traditions with them to embed in a new land.
Okay, now this is a mammoth task. Did you know what you were setting about when you started?
No, because this was something we had. You know, I lived for about 10 years in North Carolina and I come and go a lot. And so I discovered all these connections using my eyes and ears. I became very interested in Appalachian ballads, singing and old time music. And I gradually sort of felt my way into it and realised over time how deep the connections were between where I was from and where I was living. My co-author, Doug Orr, who is from North Carolina, was on a similar but sort of cross-current of a journey trying to find out more about his ancestry, because he is of that Scots-Irish lineage and had been kind of getting interested in Scottish music. So we both became friends through our musical interests.
And your radio interests.
And my radio interests, yes, working on a radio programme, as I have done for years, bringing broadly Scottish, Celtic, Irish, broadly music from Celtic roots, if you like, to North American radio listeners. But it was really, I suppose if there was a spark that ignited, it was probably at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival in 2003. Every year they pick one country of the world, rather two countries of the world, and a region of the United States or a state, and they explore their music and their folk ways. The year was 2003. The countries of focus were Scotland, the West African nation of Mali, and the region was Appalachia. And Doug Orr came up from North Carolina to take in, and his wife Darcy, to take in the music. I was over presenting some of the Scottish music shows and recording them for radio. And we sat down, we were surrounded by the music of Scotland, by West African music, and by the music of Appalachia, which, of course, Scotland and Africa, if you like, meet in the music of Appalachia with the mm-hmm. with the African-American heritage. We just found ourselves thinking, you know, this has to be, we have to do something to tell this story.
Any minute now, we're going to hear a few of the tracks because the book not only contains a fantastic amount of information, great stories, love the stories, Fiona, but it contains a fantastic CD of songs and tunes. And I'm going to almost do a desert island disc. choose your favourite song. Choose your favourite song in this in a minute. But I have to mention that just the very start of the book is just so engaging because you and Doug started exchanging letters. It's dear Fiona, dear Doug. Give us a wee bit about that, you know. How did that happen?
Well, we decided that we kind of wanted to let people know. Obviously, we wanted to get into the meat of the story, which starts out even before Scotland. We're looking at the troubadours in the south of France. We're looking at Scandinavian influences in balladry, and we're looking at Aberdeenshire and the borders. But before we wanted to begin to tell our story, we felt we had to explain to people why we were doing this, what motivated us to do this, and what drove us to tell the story, and why we're so passionate about it, and just explain a little bit about our friendship, our connection, and our own engagement with this musical story. So we wrote each other letters to kind of explain that.
It's very charming, isn't it? Dear Doug, dear Fiona, what do you think of this? I've come this far, and this is what I've arrived at, and this is what I'm thinking. It's a great start.
Thank you. And then you felt you could then begin the story, having
told
them.
Sort
of, yeah, that's right.
Now, the story begins, of course, with a foreword again from Dolly Parton.
Yes.
Okay, how did you swing that one?
Well, I'll tell you, if you're writing a book about how the music from Scotland and Ireland embedded in the Southern Appalachians, picking up influences from German music with the dulcimer, African-American influences with the banjo, there were English, French, Native Cherokee influences all coming together in the Southern Appalachians. And you think about the people through which this music has travelled in our time, nobody really represents that, the arc of the music from its most traditional roots to being internationally known and successful than Dolly Parton. Now, people do think of her, obviously, as a country music singer, an actress, but her roots are very, very much
traditional
in traditional music. And if you listen to a lot of her own songs, she's written over 3,000 songs. Uh-huh. If you listen to a lot of her own songwriting, songs like Little Sparrow, you hear the form and the melancholy, if you like, almost of the old ballads in her music. She plays clawhammer banjo. She's very much of that tradition. And I think she, when I got in touch to tell her about the book that we were doing, I sensed that she really wanted to let people know that this was very much part of her
culture too. She's very
proud of it.
I actually saw her live in concert in Aberdeen just last year. And she came on stage and the first thing she said, it's so lovely to be back in the land of the ballads I started singing. And she sang The Little Sparrow, totally unaccompanied. And it took the house down. Mm-hmm. Everybody loved it. Mm-hmm. And there was thousands of people
there. Very knowledgeable about the origins of the music as well. I mean, she's written music very much knowing what has fed her muse, if you like, what has influenced her. And she grew up listening to old ballad singers in the Southern Appalachians.
And we're going to listen to one right now. Which one is this? This is track one, isn't it?
Well, I think it would be, since we've been chatting about Dolly, we should have a wee listen. And this helps explain her roots as well, because she got together with Mairéadh Ní Mhuine and Alton, the Irish band Alton, to record a setting in front of a live audience of one of the most well-travelled of ballads, Barbara Allen, which, of course, was very well embedded in Scotland. I think Samuel Pepys refers to it in his diary as having heard that little Scotch song of Barbary Allen. And of course, it was very popular throughout the British Isles, Ireland. It travelled over to North America with the settlers and became a broadsheet over there. Yeah. So it was locked in, although there are almost 200 versions of it all over the world.
A few versions, of course, families. I'll just maintain that it started in the northeast of Scotland with the Greg Duncan collection, which it didn't, as you know, but it's in volume 6. A few versions in there if people want to find them.
Yes.
Anyway, let's listen to Dolly.
Well, Dolly paired up with Mairéadh Ní Mhuine, and she has Mairéadh sing the Irish version in Irish, and Dolly sings the version that she grew up with of Barbara Allen.
Just a great version. Right, let's listen.
Mm-hmm. When rosebuds were a-swelling, sweet William on his deathbed lay for the love of Barbary Allen. He sent his servant to the town where she was dwelling. Said, "My master said, if your name be Barbary Allen." Then slowly, slowly she got up, and slowly she went nighing. And all she said when she got there, "Young man, I think you're dying. Oh yes, I'm sick. I hear the death wind howling. No better, no better I never shall be if I can't have Barbary Allen. I can't forgive that jealous night down at the Lockwood Tavern. You drank and slighted Barbary Allen." She was she saw the hearse a coming. Lay down your corpse of clay, that I may look upon it." The more she looked, the more she moaned, till she fell to the ground in sorrow. "Sweet William died. They buried her in the old churchyard, and William's grave was nigh her. On William's grave there grew red rose, on Barbara's grave a briar. They grew and grew up the old church wall, till they could grow
Mairead na Wiri, finishing that rendition of Barbary Allen sung by Dolly Parton. And if you've just joined us, you're listening to Scots Radio. This is Freda Morrison, and this is our special edition. And we're speaking to broadcaster and writer Fiona Ritchie for Thistle and Shamrock Radio. Fiona's speaking to me about her new book, Wayfaring Strangers, that she teenute with her co-author Doug Orr. And I'm now joined by our resident folklorist Steve Byrne. This'll be wrecked up your barra.
Indeed. Oh, things, it's great to come back to this. I had the pleasure, actually, when I was doing my studies into folklore and ethnology, of actually doing a course about the traditions in Appalachia and the ballads and the songs that had gone out to to there for the British Isles, and it was awfully interesting to see the way that things had changed and the kind of songs and things that had survived. So right up my street.
Right, now we're going to be speaking about the song catchers. For the car in the States is the song catchers. We call them the song collectors in this country. Far, for instance, was Cecil Sharp.
You might have heard a place called Cecil Sharp House in London, and that is the hymn of the English Folk Dance and Song Society. And Cecil Sharp had helped to set that up, and it was one of the first organisations in the Hill of the British Isles that had really begun to collect folk songs and dance and all that sort of thing. But he actually had a trip out to the United States. He was out there as the dance advisor for a production of Midsummer Night's Dream. And when he was out there, this was about, you know, a while after he'd started finning folk songs and folk dances. There's actually a story about him on Boxing Day in 1899 where he'd seen some local dancers. I think he was at his mother-in-law's in Oxfordshire and had seen these local dances going on, and that had inspired him to kind of find out a bit more about what these local traditions were. And he went, the ball set rolling for there, and he actually became quite famous in England, the early 1900s. So he'd gone off to the States and met up with a woman called Olive Dame Campbell.
She's famous. She's in the book as well.
Indeed, aye. And she was married to a chap called John C. Campbell, who was helping out to revise the Appalachian skill system, which meant getting into the mountains and meeting with folk, etc. So by the time Cecil Sharp met her, she'd collected about 200 songs, and the rest, as they say, is history. And he did about 4 trips, I think, between 1915 and 1918.
I didn't think she got the regard or the credit for collecting as many songs as she did.
I think that's right, aye. As often is the case. You
as
know,
often the, is the case.
Aye, the folk that are kind of better kent tends to get subsumed and a bit lost during the midst of time. So it's good that the book gives her due credit.
And of course, we've got the John C. Campbell Folk School, folk camp. We're in the States right now.
Indeed.
Going from strength to strength. Okay, back to Fiona Ritchie, speaking more about her book. And we're on to the bits about the song catchers. I sense during the book that you're interested in the song catchers. You know, we've still got the song catchers.
Yeah.
In Scotland, like the School of Scottish Studies, I refer to the Gavin Gregg collection, the song catching going on there. It's still going on. But who are were the heroes in the land of the song catchers?
Well, I think that in the Southern Appalachians, they very much as they did in Ulster, were very influenced by Robert Burns and the work of Burns, and he was well known as someone who collected songs. Sir Walter Scott was a huge influence. A lot of people in the early days, they were well aware of him, obviously as the innovator of the romantic novel, but his collections of songs on the Scottish borders. So people like Burns and Scott were well known to people in the United States, and their work would have influenced people like Cecil Sharp and others. So when Cecil Sharp came over to the Southern Appalachians at the invitation of Olive Dame Campbell, who knew through her and her husband's work in helping improve social conditions in poor mountain communities, she knew that there were lots and lots of ballad singers, and he'd come over to the United States to lecture on English folk dance, and she enticed him down to the Southern Appalachians, and he couldn't believe what he discovered down there. So he was one of the key people. Now, I think in a nice way, when he went up into the mountains and started to collect songs from families of people like Sheila K. Adams, who is in the book and indeed on the CD, he collected from her forebears and many others. I think that was the first time they realised that they actually had something was quite precious. And I think the older people, after Cecil Sharp came through and started to collect, became more interested in making sure that they passed the music on, which is quite interesting. Another great collector, the Minstrel of the Mountains, was a North Carolina native from the Asheville area called Bascom Lamar Lunsford. And he was a great collector, and he collected hundreds, thousands really of songs, tunes, dances, and put them into books. So, and then of course, Jean Ritchie was a great collector within her own family. And she came over on a Fulbright scholarship to Ireland and Scotland and England to look for the origins of her own family's songs.
Referred to as the mother of folk music.
That's right, yeah.
Now, we've got to the stage where we need another track of music.
Oh, yes.
And we were going to play an instrumental, but what about a song like Blackjack Davy? That'd be an appropriate one.
Yes.
To illustrate what we're talking about today.
I think so. Well, this is lovely, actually, because you can pick a song like this and it tells the story of the migration for you, in a sense. All you have to do is listen and you can hear it. So somebody like Jack Beck, who sings a great version of The Gypsy Laddie, and we can hear how that shifted and changed when it travelled over to the United States and it became, you know, it had been the Earl O'Castle's Lady or the Gypsy Laddie in Scotland. It travelled through Ireland as the Raggle Taggle Gypsy, and it settled over on American shores as Black Jack Davy or Gypsy Davy. It was recorded, Woody Guthrie sang it, it was recorded by Bob Dylan. This is a song that has lived and lived and lived on through the generations now. It changes too. You'll hear Julie Glaub sing it, and she sings things like, well, I'll go down to the maple swamp. Mm-hmm. And we don't have maple swamps in Scotland, so it wasn't in the original. So they started to shift and change and alter the lyrics to suit their new environments. But the core story of the song of the Lady Runaway with the Gypsies continues, and it just is timeless and immortal. So we'll hear a little bit of the Gypsy Laddie, and then we'll hear Gypsy Davy with the banjo on there too, the Clawhammer banjo, which sets it in North America.
Let's hear it.
Oh, the gypsies come to our hot door, and oh, but they sang bonio, they sang say neat and say complete. They stole the heart of a lady, Lady Castle, she come down the stair with all her maids afore her all. And when they spied her wilfurt face, they cast the glamour out her all.
For me, my little white mare, speediest one of any, and I'll go down to the maple swamp, see if I can overtake her. Straddle at a lady, 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 straddle at a lady, lady, straddle at a lady, pretty all day, gone with the gypsy TV. So I went down to the maple swamp, looked so black and gaily. Yes, I went down to the maple swamp, there I spied my baby. Straddle at a lady, lady, straddle at a lady, straddle at a lady, pretty all day, gone with the gypsy Davy.
Black Jack Davy, sung by Julie Glaub, Clawhammer Banjo by Pete Sutherland. And that's Faye, a compilation CD as part of the book Wayfaring Strangers by broadcaster and writer Fiona Ritchie and co-author Doug Orr. In this special programme, I'm speaking to Fiona about her book and the epic journey that the songs, tunes and ballads took with the troubadours that travelled through Ulster to the Appalachian Mountains. In fit happened to the tunes and the songs, for they melded into the European influence and the African-American banjo. But before that, I'm joined in the studio, as is my wont, by folklorist Steve Byrne. Now, Fiona mentioned, Steve, that the influence that, you know, Robert Burns had on the songcatchers in the States was quite big. Can you tell us about the work that Burns did? Would an idea him his due credit for the collections that he did?
Well, I was struck by the influence that Fiona was mentioning in terms of Burns. I mind a few years ago we went on our honeymoon to New York, and the first two statues that you'll see in Central Park if you're getting in a certain gate, Robert Burns and Walter Scott.
Huh?
So that tells you just about everything you need to ken. In terms of the songs, I mean, we often think of him as a poet, but Burns, as Fred Freeman has often said, Fred, of course, being the producer of the Mammoth series of the Lynn Records, Complete Songs of Robert Burns, that we've played a few tracks for over the years. There's a letter in which Burns describes himself as a fiddler and a poet, and that kind of speaks to Burns's attitude to the music and the tradition. And actually, I think Fred has actually characterised Burns as being a bit of a folky. In his day, he would have gone around and picked up bits and pieces for the Appleses and melded them into his own thing. And at the time they started the Lynn Records collection, they thought they had about 368 songs that Burns had collected and put together and written himself.
Written by his own talent, you mean?
Well, indeed. I mean, that tells you just that number of songs themselves mm-hmm. tells you the level of his involvement we sang. And a lot of it is collecting for all their pieces. And he writes to Ina's correspondence after doing the Scots Musical Museum just about how he'd been hacking and hewing bits of songs together. So it tells you part of the process that he's out there and he's finding fragments. And none more so than Ina, the songs that he collected. There's an old fragment in David Herd or Lawrence Kirk's manuscripts. "Oh, what, oh, what, and weary sleep I can get nane for thinking on my dearie. Ah, the night I wak, ah, the day I'm weary. Sleep I can get nane for thinking on my dearie." Now, what song's that?
"I Wak I Know," of course.
Indeed.
That's the one that you've brought along for this programme as an example of it. Before we go into "I Wak I Know," the date of the first edition in the US.
We think it's about 1788, there or thereabouts. I haven't managed to track down an exact source, but that's a couple of years after the Kilmarnock edition came out in Scotland.
We'll so speak that about tells the Burns book, of course.
Indeed, aye. And it was being written about in the early 1800s in the American Review, some of the publications out there talking about Burns. The first Burns celebration of his birthday apparently was in 1820 in New York. And the first Burns Club was in the 1840s already in the US. So you can see already there's that kind of the mirrors the timeline, I think, that we're talking about here in terms of folk getting out there with their traditions.
Okay, tell us about "I Wak I Know," fast singing it.
This is Ossian and the voice of Tony Cuff. It's just an absolute classic of folk singing. And you can hear Burns, he's teen that fragment, and the first verse of the song, "Simmers a pleasant time, floors every colour." It's just Burns to a T, and it's an absolutely smashing version.
Here it goes.
"Summer's a pleasant time, floors of every colour. The water runs over the hall, and I long for my true lover. I walk and know, walk and I and weary, sleep I can get near for thinking on my dearie. I walk and know. When first she came to your tomb, they called her Grace MacFarlane. But now she's gay no bob, they call her off folks darling. Thinking on my dearie.
I Walk and Oh, sung by Tony Cuff with Ossian. And you're listening to Scots Radio. This is Frieda Morrison, and we are resident folklorist Steve Byrne, and I'm speaking with broadcaster and writer Fiona Ritchie about her new book, Wayfaring Strangers, which she published with her co-author Doug Orr. Now, the book traces the origins of the troubadours and the balladeers and their music that became the basis for American folk, bluegrass and country music, as I've said. And we follow the music through the Appalachian Mountains. And as Fiona says in the book, she and Doug sometimes stumbled over half-forgotten pathways, overgrown with stuff over the years. And this section, I joined Fiona again in her studio in Dunkeld, for she's based in this country, making her radio programmes on Celtic roots music for our audiences in North America through the Thistle and Shamrock radio. And we hear more about what happened, not only to the songs, but in this bit, to the tunes, finally melded, as I say, with the African-American banjo. Fiona.
Well, if you want to hear, just again, without having to think too much about this musical migration, just want to hear it. If we listen to a version of, well, Benton's Jig morphing into Benton's Dream, you'll hear the fairly strict tempo of jig time in the more Scots-Irish tradition shifting into old time with Patrick Street. And that's where what happened when the Scots-Irish came over with their fiddles and their fiddle tunes, the great collision that created the sound of the Appalachians really was when they met up with the African influence. You had this European music coming in with the Scots-Irish fiddles and then the African-American banjo. And when the two instruments met one another, in order to play together, the rhythms had to shift a little bit. They had to open up a little bit. So you got more of a syncopated rhythm. You got a little bit of this short loop of influence between the fiddle and the clawhammer banjo as each instrument learned from the other and shifted a little bit to create a new style. So let's hear Benton's Jig going into Benton's Dream and see if you can pick out that moment when it goes from jig time to old time. Thank you.
Patrick Street with Benton's Jig and Benton's Dream. And this is Freda Morrison and Scots Radio. And with me here is folklorist Steve Byrne. And we're listening to the story over Celtic musical roots, speaking with broadcaster and writer Fiona Ritchie about her new book, Wayfaring Strangers, co-written by Doug Orr. And now we've reached them within our time, with folk like Woody Guthrie, Johnny Cash, Doc Watson, Jean Redbirth, and of course, Bob Dylan. Now, before I go back to Fiona, Steve, what can we say about Bob Dylan? Because he took a lot of trips back and forth that bridge for the States to hear.
Indeed, and it's somebody that didn't really speak an awful lot about his songwriting, but in the kind of raking around for the programme, my rummels, as you cry them, came across the fact that in around 2004, he'd done an interview saying that some of his influences had come, obviously, through the Scots tradition, and a name that crops up now and again on Scots radio, of course, is Hamish Henderson, and it turns out they think that Bob probably kent some of Hamish's works through Richard Farina, who was married to Joan Baez's sister.
Oh.
So you can see how that sort of thing comes together. Oh. And Farina had come to the UK and sung with some Scottish folk singers and came to Edinburgh to visit them and got to ken Hamish Henderson. So we suspect that might be how the 51st Highland Division's Farewell to Sicily came into being into the lugs of Bob Dylan and Michty, transmuted out into the song The Times They Are A-Changing.
Of course, pipe tune Farewell to the Creeks, nah that?
Aye.
Right, okay, here we go, back with Fiona Ritchie in her studio in Dunkeld for the next chapter. We're wandering through time, we're wandering through history, and we're bound to get close to Bob Dylan by now, because he's picking up all of this as well.
Oh yeah, Bob Dylan's all through this. And, you know, he in a sense, Bob Dylan makes a connection back really to Woody Guthrie, and Woody Guthrie picked up on a lot of the old ballads as well as Bob Dylan. And from Woody Guthrie, we make a quick leap really back all the way to Robert Burns, because Burns was a huge influence on Guthrie. Mm-hmm. Guthrie was a huge influence on Dylan. And Dylan, of course, learned from people like Jean Redpath, who he met in Greenwich Village in New York City and shared a flat with. He learned songs from Jean. He learned, he absorbed ballads. He came over to London and met some Aberdonian ballad singers, Aberdeenshire ballad singers. And it had a huge influence on his songwriting. And of course, people like to try to identify which ballads influenced which of Bob's songs.
Bonnie Lass of Five View comes to mind, of course. I can't remember which song that correlates to, but there is a song there about
Bob. There are
Bill,
quite a few connections to be made. And he is not a person to accept awards and honours, but a few years ago he accepted an honorary degree from St Andrews University in Scotland in recognition of the role that Scottish ballads had played in his music, mm-hmm. which was quite something, because he's a man who's turned down more awards than any of us will ever be offered. But I think he himself wanted to note that ballads had played, the Scottish ballad tradition mm-hmm. had played a huge influence in his own songwriting.
I'm going to come back to the country, but you mentioned Jean Redpath there, and we can't go any further without mentioning just what influence she's had in bringing this bridge from Scotland to the States, to the Appalachian songs, to everything we're talking about.
Absolutely. Jean had a great sense of not only Scottish song traditions, the big ballads, the light-hearted music hall songs, the whole collection, but she also really had a sense of how it worked when it got to the United States, how it had changed, the way it had morphed in different areas. And she had an encyclopedic knowledge of it and an incredible memory. So she could sing, you could be having a conversation with her and she could quickly sing you a version of a Scottish song and then move into the American song and show you all the
that
little connections
voice.
Back and forth. She understood the work of people like the Carter family who would take bits and pieces of Scottish balladry and make them into their own songs, the way Dylan did, the way Burns did. She had a great sense of the carrying stream. She also was one of our voices of tradition in the book. We interviewed over 40 people to bring the wisdom of a lot of these people, song collectors, song catchers, music makers, into the book. We wanted them to speak for themselves. And it's sobering to note that in the period of time that we were working on this book, which was a fair period of time, how many of these folks actually passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Pete Seeger, Mike Seeger, Doc mm-hmm. Watson, Jean. And since we finished, also Jean Ritchie. and others, and of course Sheila Stewart, and others that have passed away in this period of time. So it's a reminder to us to make sure that we hear what these people have got to share with us while they are still around, and get them involved in projects like this so that we can record what they have to say for posterity.
Well, this is what makes your job so important, Fiona. I'm sure Jean Redbuff told you that a few times as well. And we forget that time does march on, and mm-hmm. we've only got a limited window in this.
And the thing is that I suppose in our interviewing people for this book, you were wanting to reach people who had grown up in the pre-media age, so that you wanted to talk to people who really had learned music by listening to people singing and had absorbed it in that way. Not that there's anything wrong with absorbing music from records and from radio and from downloads and from YouTube and everything, which is wonderful. It's all part of this wonderful evolution. But I think by reaching people like Jean Ritchie, Jean Redpath, Pete Seeger, Mike Seeger and others who were old enough to have grown up around the music before it became a media entity, you tap into a sort of seam of knowledge that's possibly dying with them.
Mm-hmm. It's a special seam that you have uncovered. And in the book you say that this was a special epic journey. But the journey with the book is just as extraordinary as well, because I've been trying to follow all your meanderings. You've hardly been in one place twice in the whole world, and you've covered the whole world. Just what have you got out of this journey within the journey?
Well, it's actually, you were absolutely right. At the very beginning of our chat, you sort of asked me if I knew what I was getting into when I started the book, and we really didn't. Mm-hmm. We wanted to trace this music. We wanted to use the music as our guide, if you like, to travel through time and through communities and through culture from Scotland through Ulster and into Southern Appalachia. And so we started thinking about writing the book. We thought, you know, we have to focus. We can't write about that. And we've no time to write about this. And we must make sure we don't get strayed down that road. And then, of course, as we went along, we realised, hang on a minute, you know, we can't not write about that. And we must go there. And we have to stray down these roads. So it became a series of great meanderings. And the book took a lot longer because of that. But thank goodness it did. And it took us to the home of people like Pete Seeger to sit with him for an afternoon and get his memories and his reflections on it all.
How special was that?
Absolutely a privilege. And in a sense, by working on the book, it made, you know, we made sure that we took time to sit with people like Jean Redpath and Jean Ritchie and others. And so I now look at the book as being, as having been a tremendous gift to me, to stop and spend some time with some very special people to talk about the book. But also it gave me this the lovely gift of their company at that time in their lives. And also just the discoveries we made ourselves. And then realising, since the book has come out, and taking it out to people and with performers and singing some of the songs, talking about the book, is realising the emotional impact it has on people. When we were in Nashville recently to share the book at a book festival, a woman came up to the table, we were signing books, and she was a member of the Carter family, which is a fairly, you know, quite a big clan now. Yeah. And she said, I'm so-and-so, Jenny Carter, whatever. And she told me that her great-grandfather was and all that. And she said, I've already bought 4 copies of the book, but I just had to come back and get another one and get you to sign it. And how emotional she was about it, because, of course, it was speaking mm-hmm. about her family, and her family are very profiled in there. And other people who came up to us and said, you know, this is the book I've been waiting to read my whole life, because this is my family's story. And the country scene that was very much influenced by the likes of the Carter family, and A.P. Carter himself was a songcatcher. He used to travel around the mountain communities of their locale in Virginia and Tennessee, looking for old songs that he could then shape his Carter family songs from. And those were the old ballads.
No. I mentioned Doc Watson. You think it's about time that we listen to Doc Watson?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Doc Watson is just a mainstay of this music, and his origins were with a Scots ancestor who came over in the 1700s and settled in the Southern Appalachians, Doc from Deep Gap, North Carolina. And one of the songs that is very much associated with Doc and with Jean Ritchie, in fact, who was a great friend of his, was the old ballad Matty Groves, which when it came over to the Appalachians, it changed into the Shady Grove song. It became Shady Grove, a lovely old love song, really. What you'll get to hear also on this version of it is Doc playing with David Holt, a tremendous multi-instrumentalist and a great master of clawhammer banjo.
Here we go. Cheeks as red as a blooming rose and eyes are the prettiest brown. She's the darling of my heart, sweetest little girl in town. I wish I had a glass of wine and bread and meat for two. I'd set it out on a golden plate and give it all to you. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I say. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound to go away, Piccadilly. Yeah. Now when I was a little boy, I wanted a Barlow knife. Now I want little Shady Grove to say she'll be my wife. A kiss from pretty little Shady Grove is sweet as brandy wine. Ain't no girl in this whole world that's prettier than mine. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I say. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound to go away. I went to see my Shady Grove, she is standing in the door, her shoes and stockings in her hand and her little bare feet on the floor. I wish I had a big old horse and the grain to feed him on. Little Shady Grove, stay at the house and feed him when I'm gone. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I say. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound to go away. In the summertime, apples in the fall. If I can't have a little Shady Grove, I don't know y'all at all. If I had a needle and thread as fine as I could sew, I'd sew a pretty girl to my side and down the road we'd go. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I say. Shady Grove, my little love, bound to go away.
That was the legendary Doc Watson with David Holt. And that track is part of a compilation CD contained within a book card, Wayfaring Strangers, written by broadcaster and writer Fiona Ritchie with co-writer Doug Orr. And I'll give you the link to Fiona's Thistle and Shamrock radio website in just a minute in this special New Year programme. You're listening to Scots Radio. This is Freda Morrison. With me is folklorist Steve Byrne. Steve, of course, the Carrion Stream comes to mind loud and clear here in an international perspective.
Well, it's actually, I was just saying, we think about it. I mean, there's tons of material out there. As I said earlier, I had the privilege of studying with Professor Fay, East Tennessee State University, who I was over for the year. And I've got a wheen of books here. One of the big thickest deans sitting just next to me is a thing called the Warner Collection, which is Anne and Frank Warner, who were a couple of collectors that went around the Appalachians mostly and collected hundreds of songs. And for, I suppose it'd be cried a seminal book, maybe the kind of first thing that folk would associate with American folk song collecting would be John and Alan Lomax. Well, the Warner Collection's right up there with that. And leafing through it, there's all sorts of songs that would ring bells for folk back home. And if you kind of unpick it and look at the carrying stream flowing the other direction, you find hints of songs. And sometimes songs, versions lifted direct for Scotland, you would find the same ones here. Things like The Lass of Glen Shee, written by Andrew Sharp from Perthshire. There's a boy called Yankee John Galusha, recorded in the 1940s, singing that, in partly in Broad Scots. And songs like Paddle the Road Wi' Me, which folk that has ever heard Malinky sing might recognise that.
The road again.
Indeed, so. And these are things that are coming out of things like John Ord's Bothy Songs and Ballads. You know, they're songs that be recognisable, as I say, to folk in Scotland. And it doesn't just gang in one direction, because another thing, that song Shady Grove and Matty Groves and the wider family of that particular ballad, Little Musgrave and Lady Barnard, there's a version of Jeannie Robertson singing that. And it set me thinking when I was cataloguing it for the Kiss the Riches project, because she sings a line in it, "Lord Donal ain't at home." Now, I didn't ken about you. That's nae the broadest Aberdeenshire dialect ever.
Nae a lot of Aberdeenshire and ain't.
Indeed, indeed. So we unpicked it a wee bit. It turns out that she probably learnt it off an American singer and folklorist, Sandy Payton,
mm-hmm.
Had come over and took a lot of photographs and was involved with the folk revival and things like that. So Jeannie had been picking up bits and pieces for the American traditions that had gone over there and come back to Scotland, which is half interesting. One of the things, there's a great book about the ballads in Appalachia. It's called Some Ballad Folks by Tom Burton, who had been mm-hmm. at East Tennessee State University for a while. One of the things that you recognise or that's a feature of the ballads that gang over to North America is that they lose certain elements, and that's not just folk misunderstanding things or putting their own local words and places onto them, but the supernatural element seems to disappear out of the ballads for reasons that we're no that sure about. But something like the Twa Sisters, if folks ever heard the ballad The Twa Sisters, there's either a harp or a fiddle that is made out of the bones of the deed mm-hmm. sister that is washed up in the mill dam, but that doesn't appear at all in some of the versions. Aye, it's literally just gings into being a kind of, you know, competition for a lover sort of thing. So
I should mention, of course, my big hero is Dolly Parton. You can that. I've spoken about that many a times. But I should mention that my favourite song she sings is called Wild Flowers, and that's sung to the tune Father John McMillan O'Bara. And, you know, it's just the songs maybe is coming this way, and we're talking about the tunes, but there's Dolly Parton coming back across the bridge to pick up a tune to use it for one of her songs just recently.
Indeed, aye.
It's still going on. Right. As I said, I'm speaking to Fiona Ritchie about her new book, Wayfaring Strangers, co-written by Doug Orr, and it's about the epic journey teamed by folk for this country across to the Appalachian Mountains. But as the songs logically have words, fit happened to the Scots language in particular. Do the words still exist? Back to that wee studio in Dunkeld, Perthshire, with Fiona again. Now, this being Scots Radio, there's a lot of folk going to be listening to this thinking, well, the Scots words must have been blended into some of the American words or the Appalachian words. Have you come across any of the
words?
Yes,
certainly. Up in the southern Appalachian Mountains, you were in very, very densely forested country. And when the Scots-Irish first arrived in Philadelphia, they headed out to the Pennsylvania backcountry, but found it was pretty heavily settled by Germans, and they couldn't really get a freehold on that land. So they were struggling really to, some of them did remain, and you can tell by the place names in Pennsylvania, there's a lot of sort of Ulster names. There's towns, little townships called Derry or Londonderry, all dotted around. But in time, and indeed for some of them pretty quickly, they realised that if they were going to get their hands on some land, they needed to move a little bit further afield. So they travelled southward on the Great Philadelphia Wagon Road, a long journey down into the Carolinas. And then they were offered, if they were willing to settle in the mountains, they could get up there and get some land. Now, it wasn't the sort of countryside that most people were willing to go up and farm on. Very densely forested. Perhaps some of the native populations there would not be too happy to see you arrive. Wild animals, all of that. But the Scots-Irish were up for it. They'd, in a sense, been born to that. They'd been moving and moved on in some ways. They'd been frontiers people even in Ulster. So they were up for the task. And they went away up into these hollers, as they called them, these narrow, narrow valleys in this densely forested area. And they get quite comfortable being way out on their own. In fact, they would say, if you could see a plume of a neighbour's smoke, it was time to move on. You know, and they settled into such deep forest that they would also say you'd have to lie back and look up to see out. It was so densely wooded. So their language did become old-fashioned, if you like. Now, when I was first in North Carolina, somebody said to me, oh, you know, you should go up to the mountains of North Carolina and hear them up there. They sing old ballads and they speak Elizabethan, was how somebody put it to me. And I thought, really? So anyway, I went up there, of course, and what did I hear? But this very, very strong accent. But you hear words, you hear them using words like that have definitely come from the Scots-Irish and never gone away. Like they'll call onions, ingans. And they'll say clout for a cloth or for clothes, words that don't exist anywhere in the United States and are, and I found that really great. Someone like Sheila Kay Adams is actually good for that. And she and I sat down and we started trading words back and forth, and she couldn't believe that a lot of the words that she just used in her family were actually Scots words.
Fiona Ritchie, writer and broadcaster, and what a privilege that was to sit there in our studio in Dunkeld and wander through the pages of our book, Wayfaring Strangers, co-written by Doug Orr. More information in a while. Steve, Scots words, still in, there.
Indeed, I was having a wee look at some videos and things online, and you can hear that folk are still using them, folk speaking in half-abroad accents in Appalachia, but there's a few words that folk would recognise here. The word for afraid, the English word afraid, would be afeard, a bit like feared in Scots. For your snack, you would say a piece in Appalachia as well as
a
in
piece.
Scotland. A piece, aye.
Piece there now, piece
and
there.
If you were putting your piece in on a thing, you would put it in a poke.
Ooh.
So there you are. Still words that are being used in Appalachia.
Piece in a poke.
That clearly you would think had come
good
from.
Good on you. But this is an important book, isn't it?
Indeed. I think it draws together in a modern context a lot of the kind of stuff that maybe for a while has been stuck in the kind of folkloric academic world, you might say. The things I've been touching upon, they're maybe a bit lesser kent outside of that realm in terms of folk being aware of the throughput of the music and the traditions that have come across the Atlantic. And
you've also been writing about it in the Scots Language Centre as well, haven't you?
Aye, I was asked today about Scots song on the Scots Language Centre site, scotslanguage.com, and it's just about Scots song elsewhere. So I've written about Scots song in Ulster and other parts of Europe, from folk who picked up translations of Burns and whatever, but also had drawn together some of the resources I was speaking about earlier on for Appalachia as well. So there's the folk can get on to scotslanguage.com and click on Scots song and hear it.
We've been on a great journey. The book is called Wayfaring Strangers, Fiona Ritchie and Doug Orr, published by UNC Press, price on application. And you can hear more through Fiona through her Celtic Roots music radio programmes, broadcast through Thistle and Shamrock and Thistle Radio. Look up thistleradio.com. And on our webpage, you can find magical links to Thistlepod and other things. And I'm going back to Fiona for a final song, but I'll leave you with the words as quoted by Ceris Matthews, Welsh folk singer, author and broadcaster, in her text about the book we're speaking about. She says, songs can take us on extraordinary journeys. They respect neither border nor time. And by following them, we can chart the movement of generations of people. In Wayfaring Strangers, Fiona Ritchie and Doug Orr took a long look at this story using Scottish songs as their compass. Here's Fiona to take us to the last song and the final bit of the special programme and special interview. We follow that compass again. For me, Freda Morrison, Steve Byrne and soon sorter Richie Werner, may your ain journey this new year be full of fun and gweed folk. And Steve, I'll leave you with a last toast.
May the best ye have ever seen be the worst you'll ever see. May the moose ne'er lee your gurnal wi' a teardrap in its ee. May ye aye keep hale and hearty till you're auld and young to dee. And may ye aye just be sae happy as I wish ye aye to be.
The hale of that and mair. Buy the new and we'll leave you with Fiona Ritchie. Right, we're going to finish with the parting glass.
Yes.
Fast sings it.
Well, in this case, it's Amy White. Now, this was a song that was popular, as you know, throughout Scotland and Ireland. In fact, before Auld Lang Syne came along and became the go-to parting song, it was the parting glass. And there are many different versions of it. In fact, Len Graham, who's in our book, also sings a fantastic version from County Antrim. But this is a version that is very popular also in the Southern Appalachians. And it seems to be that this is a story, the story of the music migration from Scotland to Ulster to Southern Appalachia and all those folk that the nameless, anonymous folk that took the music over with them. It seems as though their life was a series of partings, and they would have been singing this at the cottage hearth of Aberdeenshire and the borders at the Cayley houses of Ulster. They would have sang it on the quayside, perhaps in Derry, Londonderry, and
very
Philadelphia.
Vivid memory of Sheila Stewart singing this very song.
Yes.
Her version of The Parting Glass.
Uh-huh.
But you're going to have your version of The Parting Glass, but it's this
Amy White
this
will sing
Amy
it.
White's and, version of The Parting
it's
Glass.
It's a beauty, and it's sung very widely still in the Southern Appalachians, having come all the way all those years ago. And I imagine it's been sung many times by these intrepid wayfarers.
Well, speaking about intrepid wayfarers, you're fully intrepid yourself. I can't imagine how many miles you've clocked up with this book.
Quite a few.
But the appreciation that I've been noticing out of the place that you've been wandering to has been immense. You must be very pleased.
Very, very pleased. And it's been, you know what it is like when you've been working, you know, very hard on any kind of a project, you're relieved when it's delivered. But I must say, just absolutely gratified by how well it's been received. We wanted to do it justice. We wanted to tell this story in a way that paid tribute to all these countless hundreds of thousands of people that were responsible for shifting this culture around the way they've done, in the open-minded and inclusive way that they did it. And also to make sure that people realise that this sort of braiding and weaving of European, African, Indigenous American influences created this tapestry of Southern Appalachian music. And in a sense, if you extracted any one of these threads, you would lose what's so beautiful about it. So it's been a tremendous joy to get to share it and to tell these stories. And it's opened doors to many more stories, actually, Frieda, because when you tell a story, you always get one back. You wouldn't believe the amazing stories we've heard from people as we're taking the book out there. It's been a joy.
Right, The Parting Glass from Amy White. Fiona, thank you so much for this. And here's to the next book.
Yes.
It'll be there somewhere.
It's there somewhere.
Of all the money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company. And of all the harm that e'er I've done, alas, it was to number of me. And all I've done for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass, and good night and joy be with you. Wish me one more day to stay, but since it falls unto my lot that I should rise and you should not, I will gently rise and softly call good. But since it has